you're getting ready to start what I believe is season 18.
That's right. America's Test Kitchen season 18, Cook's Country season 11 is what we're working up to. So two big projects, yeah.
Absolutely. How has the first season of hosting gone for you all?
Awesome. A whirlwind, but awesome. Big,
Excellent.
big learning experience too, definitely.
Because your backgrounds are both in the, obviously in the kitchen. And tell us a little bit about just the, really quickly, the sort of the path that led you to this point where you're now hosting this sort of this huge thing on public television.
So we were on, we've been on the show since the very beginning, since season one, which hopefully is buried somewhere deep in a deep hole. We were 12, mind you, because 18 years ago, then we'd just be turning, what,
Exactly.
30 now.
Oh, no.
So we've been on the show for the since the beginning. Each been there a little under 20 years. So we've seen a lot happen throughout the years. We know the recipes. We've tasted every recipe. We actually tallied up how many recipes have been developed in the test kitchen and therefore how many we've eaten. Over 20,000 that we've eaten since we've been there.
A lot of calories.
Oh, yeah, we got figures to prove it. No, but we know the stories inside and out. We started at the bottom of the food chain. I did the shopping and the dishes.
And I started working there just a few months before Julia, and I was really glad when she started because until then I was doing the shopping and the dishes. So we did shopping dishes. We were test cooks for Cook's Illustrated magazine at the time, and the book division was just starting to get started at that point. But we did all the prep work, the cooking. Very few other people in the kitchen. It was a very small staff at that point. And over the years, we grew into our own divisions. Julia started working in the book department. I started heading up Cook's Country magazine and development for that. And we both worked our way up the ranks, slowly but surely, plodding along. And this opportunity presented itself for us to, go from being one of the cooks on the television show to being one of the hosts. And it was a pretty tremendous opportunity.
Wow. And when you think about it, we really know the place inside and out from the very, some pretty humble beginnings in a tiny, tiny test kitchen with just a big island, one sink where everything was pretty much hand washed, to the new space that we just moved into earlier this week. The test kitchen is now 15,000 square feet. And it's not one kitchen. It's more like five kitchen, three kitchens, two sets. There's another kitchen with a photo studio. It's huge. And the things we're going to be able to do. But I think knowing the history of the company, the mantra hasn't changed. We want to develop recipes that work for everyone in a home cook, no matter if you're experienced or you're new at cooking, no matter if you have an electric stove or a gas, have lots of equipment at your beck and call, or you're working with the basics. Our recipes should work because we test them over and over. And that mantra has stayed the same. And in terms of the show, I think we're really eager to show the work that goes into each recipe, that's the behind the scenes. So instead of having a person out in front sort of explaining it all, we want to open the doors up, pull back the curtain, and show all the hard work that goes into each recipe.
Yeah, the recipes are the stars
That's
of
it.
the show.
That's
We
it.
just happen to be the ones presenting them, and we're bringing more cast members out front as well. People that are there every day, they're doing the hard work day to day. They're in the salt mines, and we want them to have the accolades that they deserve and to be appreciated.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I see you have a book
Yes.
with you. And we're going to get to that.
All
We're going to
right.
get to that. My one of my my focus today, I think, is we have the holidays coming up.
Yes.
Things are coming. And
They're a coming.
they're a coming. I mean, this is the time when kitchens are especially busy
Sure.
everywhere, even for people who are working, 60, 70 hours a week, they're putting the time in. So before we get into that, I want to ask you, this is your career. What do you both do during the holidays? How do you approach this?
It's, I think, key for me is planning.
Yes.
If you don't plan and try to do as many things ahead, you're going to get very easily, you're going to be overwhelmed.
Easily.
Especially Thanksgiving in particular, to me, there's so much importance placed on that meal, and it only happens once a year.
It's like a culinary Super Bowl. I mean,
Right.
it's you pull out all the biggest dishes, the biggest bird you can find. I mean, it's It's something right. else. And it can rattle the nerves of the most experienced cook.
And besides the mashed potatoes, you probably don't make those dishes any other time of the year. So, you know, everything's you have to relearn every year.
Yep.
So I think Julie and I both try to make as much ahead of time as we possibly can. A lot of planning.
Mm-hmm. I remember one time I had to go to a relative's house, and at the last minute, they fell ill, and I had to step in with the whole meal, not even out of my kitchen. I had to half-prep stuff and bring it there. And my saving grace was I had a detailed outline every day. I had to buy this day, this day, prep on different days. And when I got to the final day, everyone was a relative, so everyone had a job, and I had a timeline. They were laughing at me. They like, you really have just overdone it. Like, this is crazy. Timeline. Everyone stepped up. I could go for a walk in the middle of the day and know that the turkey was going to be fine. So-and-so was having the gravy. And we all had a great time because it was just organized. So nerd out on your organization. Go note crazy. Buy a notebook. Make timelines. And then you can relax into that. You've done all the thinking about it.
Could you give me a few examples of this preparation in addition to the timeline? Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you have found consistently year to year that you need to do in terms of preparation?
I think Bridget and I could probably say this at the same time.
Make your gravy. Well, gravy for us. Gravy is a beverage to me. That's the only reason I make the turkey is to have the gravy.
It's a game changer. Even if you're going to someone else's house, if you show up with a big pot of homemade turkey gravy, you're a rock star.
That's true.
Like, you know, leave the pies to someone else, bring gravy, and you won't be forgotten. Like,
because
you will be the hero.
The worst sins can be covered with great gravy.
And you can make your gravy ahead of time. You don't have to wait for the drippings for the bird. This is what it's amazing. You can buy turkey thighs. You can use turkey wings, turkey drumsticks. And you can roast them with the vegetables and make nothing but gravy. And then when the turkey's done, you can add those drippings to it. But, you know, the gravy is the thing that happens at the last minute, right? Usually people wait for the turkey to come out of the oven. And you have to let your turkey rest for at least half an hour, preferably more like 45 minutes to an hour before you carve it. In that time, I mean, that's like go time. You have to make sure the mashed potatoes done, the salad's dressed, everything's out on that needs to be out at room temperature. You got to do the gravy, you got to pour the wine, you know, you got to fill the water glasses. Like, that is when everything has to happen. If that gravy is out of the way, mm-hmm. suddenly it's a burden that's been lifted.
I heard pie dough mentioned.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the freezer's your friend the month before the holidays, at least. You've got the gravy in there that you've made. Pie dough as well. So you can make your pie dough, put it in a little circle after you've put it together in the food processor. It goes together very easily. Put it in a little circle, wrap it a couple of times in plastic wrap, put it in a Ziploc bag, and put it in the freezer and let it thaw. You know, a few days before Thanksgiving or Christmas, any other holiday you want to bake a pie. But I also bake the pie the day before. I've never heard anybody complain that this pie was not baked on the same day. And certain pies are great actually made even the day before. I think apple pie tastes better the day before.
Flavors can settle.
Yeah, and pecan pie. So yeah, a lot of these pies should be made the day before. Just, you know, anybody who complains is not getting invited back the next year.
What about turkey? This is its own show.
Yes.
Yes.
Turkey's a monster.
What are some don'ts?
All right. Well, don't overcook your bird. I think that's the number one thing. But there are ways that you can prevent that, and that's with salting and brining ahead of time. Both of those, brining will add moisture, a little bit of moisture to the bird turkey so that it's not dried out. But salting is something that we've started veering towards, and that's where you rub salt all over the turkey. You put it on a rack, let it sit in your fridge uncovered overnight. And the salt works its way into the meat. It changes the makeup or the structure of the meat. The meat fibers are running all in one direction. And when you add salt to the equation, it kind of rearranges them almost more like a matrix or a web so that any moisture that's in there, we're going to be trapped in that web and not cook out as easily. You still can overcook it, but it's going to be a lot harder. And I think that and using the pop-up timer is the other big sin.
That's evil.
Of cooking.
The pop-up timer of evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't use the pop-up timer.
Yeah,
don't take it out of the bird because you don't want to leave a gaping hole in the breast. Juices can leak out. So leave it in there, but ignore it. We actually mail ordered pop-up timers. We got a big bag of them. We put them in water of different temperatures to see when they pop. They pop when the turkey reached over 180 degrees. And if you do that and the turkey's still in the oven and you pull it out, remember there's carryover cooking. So you take the turkey out as it sits on the counter. It's still hot. It's still cooking, even though it's not in the oven. So that turkey's going to be well over 200 degrees, which is bone dry. Ideal temperature for turkey breast meat is 160 to 165. And so if you pull the turkey out at 160 to 165, that's for the breast meat. As it rests, you'll then see that pop-up timer go because it'll reach 180 as it rests. The pop-up timer of evil.
So you were using an internal thermometer.
Right. That's a digital thermometer. Yep, you can get inexpensive ones for $20. You can go all out and get the Mac Daddy one that's about $100. They all work really well. Yep. You temp it in a couple places. Because I think people take one temperature and they kind of go with it. Really poke it in a couple places. Go with the lowest temperature as your gauge.
Excellent. Any other turkey do's?
Yeah. So after you brine it or salt it, leave it in the refrigerator uncovered overnight. It's called air drying. So it's you don't need to truss a turkey. Just leave it on the rack. And so it's uncovered. So the air is going to dry out the skin. And that dried skin browns like you wouldn't believe. It gets golden and crisp all over.
I think another one Julia touched on it is letting that turkey rest when it comes out of the oven. It's so important to do that because if you cut into it too quickly, all the juices will just flood out of the bird and onto the platter, onto your floor, onto your carving board. They're not inside the turkey where they belong.
Yeah.
So let it rest.
Yeah. And one more tip, carve it in the kitchen. Don't do the Norman Rockwell. Norman Rockwell scene at the table where you're trying to carve it. It's just a mess. I mean, the thing is an unusual shape. You got upside, downside, dark meat, white meat.
All right.
You know, if people want to see it, they can walk through the kitchen, admire the golden turkey, but then take it back to the kitchen, close the doors, carve it, put a big old smock on, carve it because it's juicy and messy, slice it up, lay it on a beautiful platter, a warm platter, and bring the platter to the table. It'll save your shirt, basically, at the dinner table.
Do a turkey parade.
Yes. I think there's one of those around somewhere.
Somewhere in New York, I think.
Maybe.
So, thank you on that. Beyond the turkey, so we'll talk about side dishes. You have a new book, and it sounds like there might be a couple of these in the book that are going to be sides that you will use in your for your Thanksgiving Day and Christmas for that matter. What are some choice side dishes that you find yourself using year in, year out?
Roasted butternut squash. So buy the whole squash. It takes about 5 minutes to really peel that thing with a peeler, cut it in half lengthwise, and then slice it. And then you roast it, and you can garnish it with brown butter, with nuts, with herbs, with a yogurt tahini sauce. Interesting flavors you can add to the Thanksgiving table, but also it caters to those who are vegan or vegetarian or gluten-free or have a different eating style. You don't need to give them anybody a meat substitute. You just need to have more vegetables on the table.
Interesting things.
That everybody can enjoy. Yeah. So butternut squash is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I'd say one of my favorites actually, Julia. It was her recipe that she developed years and years ago as a cornbread and sausage stuffing.
Ooh, yeah, it's good.
And this is one that actually you could add vegan meat substitute to this.
The Seitan crumbles,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, something like
or tempeh.
That. And vegetable broth instead of chicken broth. And it still comes together, but it's this toasty cornbread that's in there that really makes a difference instead of the white. We have this constant discussion about stuffing versus dressing.
That's true.
White sandwich bread
I'm
versus
from New
cornbread.
York.
I'm
from
West
from
Virginia,
Virginia.
So I'm a cornbread girl, and she's Miss Sandwich Bread.
I'm sandwich bread, and I call it stuffing.
Yes, and it's dressing because you're not putting it in the bird.
So tell me about some mashed potatoes. What's the best way to attack these things? Is this something that you can do the day before or the day of? What is your strategy with the mashed potatoes? Are they even included in the dinner?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There would be anarchy in my house.
Totally anarchy.
The kids would just throw the table over if there were no mashed
potatoes.
Because, my husband, myself. I don't make the mashed potatoes the day before, but I peel them and I keep them whole in water.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that overnight. And to me, the peeling potatoes, especially if you've got a lot of people coming over and you're peeling 5 pounds or more potatoes, that's a great job to have out of the way. And it's already in the water, you know, so you want to cover it with water so they don't brown. The next day, it's a good idea to drain that water and refill the pot. But I store them in the pot that I'm going to be cooking them in, right in the fridge. That way, you know, they're already in there. I just have to drain them, refill it, and then simmer them away. Julie, do you make it fully ahead or?
No, I peel potatoes like you do. For me, excuse me, it's the type of potato that matters. The Yukon Gold. By far, my favorite mashed potato. A lot of people swear by Idaho's, and they have that russet sort of deep, hearty flavor, but I find they're just a little starchy. The Yukon Gold has a slightly buttery flavor, and it has very creamy texture, and that's what I like.
And one of our colleagues loves this dish, and it is really, really good, and every year I forget to make it, Jack Bishop. He makes the mashed potato casserole that we developed several years ago, and he loves it because there's no last minute making of mashed potatoes right before you're cooking. So you can put this all together, put it in the dish, and bake it, and then it comes out of the oven. You've got to let that thing cool at least 20 minutes, though, because it is super hot. It's hot potatoes. And so, you know, that takes away that last minute prep of mashed potatoes, but you still have that lovely fluffy texture that you can put on your plate. It has a nice crisp topping on it. You can still add other things to it.
I know a lot of people that keep their mashed potatoes warm in a slow cooker. So you can make them earlier in the day, and you put them in the slow cooker on low. And back when I was catering, we used to put little pats of butter. We used to poke them down in the potato. So when it's time to serve, you stir, and you have a fresh sort of little pockets of melted butter that gets stirred in to flavor it. And so that works well if you want to do it a couple hours ahead.
Sounds amazing.
Are you getting hungry?
Yes, I am.
What are some other uses of the slow cooker this time of year?
It's a great mulled cider pot, I have to say. It's perfect for mulled wine and mulled cider. It's going to keep it hot. If you don't have one of those canisters for entertaining that you want to keep things hot, it's great for that. It's great for dips. We found out with hot dips, so you have a lot of people over and they want to have a chip and dip kind of thing, so anything that you want to keep hot.
Keeping the gravy warm.
Keeping gravy warm.
If you had make-ahead gravy, you could keep it off the stove entirely and just rewarm it in the slow cooker off to the side.
Yep.
And I think part of the game plan when planning ahead like this is think about what's going in and out of the oven and what you need on the stovetop. And then what can you get out of those two zones?
True.
It's like the end zone. So you're going to get it out of the end zones and into different places. The other thing that comes in handy, and this is going to sound really silly, is a heating pad. Plug a heating pad in, put a plate on it, put your rolls on it, or something that just you want a little warm, and suddenly it's not in the oven, it's not in the way, but it's doing what it needs to do.
I thought you were going to say because your back's hurting.
Oh, yeah. And keep it plugged in for when you're doing the dishes.
That's for later.
Yeah. Yes.
So you touched on the butternut squash. For people who are not meat eaters, what are some other centerpiece entree ideas that they could consider?
There was a mushroom galette that we made several years ago, and it was so impressive that meat eaters started putting it on their table as an option. It is beautiful. It's wild mushrooms, gorgonzola, a little bit of gorgonzola. Julia was saying earlier, we were talking about this very dish, she's saying you could probably use vegan cheese for that with success. And it's very concentrated flavor, and it's a rustic galette.
It's beautiful.
So you have this big circle of dough, and you add the filling to it, and you just fold the dough over just a little bit, so you still see this beautiful amalgam of mushrooms and cheese right in the middle, and it's bubbling, and it's hot. It's so elegant. So it's not one of those things that you're going to put in front of somebody who doesn't eat meat, and they're like, oh, great, I just got Brussels sprouts. Thanks very much. It's actually super impressive and rich and satisfying.
The other thing that comes to mind are cauliflower steaks because they're substantial. You can get them really brown. You serve them with a lovely green sauce like a salsa verde or Persillade sauce. And again, it feels substantial. It feels hearty. But everyone's going to want to dig into them. So I think if you have a vegetarian at the Thanksgiving table, which I think most of us do nowadays, it's not that unusual, you don't need to replace the turkey. You just need to put more things on the table, maybe a few extra grains, maybe a few extra vegetables.
Excellent. Excellent. And you mentioned Brussels sprouts. Do you do those?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. If you can find them, what's going on? They're almost impossible. Every supermarket's always sold out of Brussels sprouts. I want people to stop eating them so I can find them at the supermarket. That's what always happens. There's always one darling.
On a big comeback kick right now, Brussels sprouts. They used to be like, sort of verboten. Nobody liked them. But now even my daughter's asking for them. So they're hip again.
I'm a believer. I'm a huge believer. Yeah. And when they're executed just right, the place over here in Wisconsin, they do those with a cinnamon with them. It's nice.
That sounds good.
Very nice. So when you all do that, what kind of seasonings? What's your strategy as far as seasonings with the Brussels sprouts?
Well, there's a couple ways I do them. Like you mentioned, roasted with the seasonings, but I love Brussels sprout salad.
Yeah, that's
where
what I was gonna
shave
say.
Them into more of a slaw.
Oh yeah,
and you can add a hot dressing to that, like a hot onion and vinegar kind of dressing, and almost makes it pickly. Or you can add something that has cherries and walnuts, mm-hmm. things like that, dried cherries, walnuts. These more autumnal flavors that you want to work in there, cranberries, a little bit of cheddar, and just those, it just makes it so interesting. I made it a couple of years ago. I had that on a buffet at Thanksgiving, and I thought nobody's gonna eat this. I'm gonna be eating Brussels sprout salad for the end of my life because I made it for 15 people.
That must have taken you forever.
Processor.
Oh, you do the food processor.
Food processor to shave those things down.
Oh yeah, to do it by hand takes a long time.
Yeah,
I love doing it though.
For four, definitely. Yeah. For 15, the food processor comes up. But it was the first thing to go. First thing to go.
Really?
And there were people that did not even know that they liked Brussels sprouts were eating that, which kind of goes against my whole, I wish people would stop eating Brussels sprouts.
So let's say, didn't do a timeline. Let's say we're too focused on shopping. We're up against it.
Mm-hmm.
How do we save Thanksgiving? How do we save Christmas? Yes. What are the easier?
Yes, I've been there.
What are the dishes if we have 48 hours
mm-hmm.
and we got to mobilize?
Yep.
What are we doing?
You're skipping appetizers and dessert and you're purchasing those. You don't have time.
And bread.
You're buying rolls. You're going to the bakery to pick up desserts. And for appetizers, you're going to do a block of cheese and some crackers. And really focus on the main meal. Focus on the big things that, you know, people will throw the table over if it's not there, like the turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing. Don't be afraid if it's better to have something on the table than nothing. So if you got to buy your gravy, buy your gravy. You can actually buy some pretty good gravies frozen, different makers and often very local, local stores, local markets, and even sometimes restaurants have homemade turkey gravy that you can buy. And again, that's in a pinch. And so that's what I would say. And part of it is don't get too ambitious. Things take a lot longer than you think they do, especially if you haven't planned. Even the act of organizing yourself to begin cooking takes time. And so you probably, if you haven't planned, you have a lot less time than you even think you do. So stick to the basics. Yeah. And if anyone's coming and they offer to bring something, take them up on it.
Yes.
People want to help. People don't want to see you struggle. They want you to have a good time and you want them to have a good time. They're happy to jump in the kitchen and help. They're happy to bring something. So another thing is figure out what needs to get done and who might be able to help you and make it part of the fun.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that 48 hours in advance, if your turkey is still frozen, you're not going to be able to use it for Thanksgiving. You better go out and get an unfrozen turkey at that point. It's probably not going to thaw all the way.
There are emergency thaw directions where you put it in big things of water and you change the water really often.
Yeah, every half hour you have to change the water, which means that you're in the kitchen now for hours and hours and hours.
It's a beer drinking game, right? Time to change the water.
So, it's okay. You can have that turkey later on, save it. You can have it later on, make more gravy.
Thanksgiving number two.
Exactly. But go out and get it fresh or get turkey parts. I actually love to roast turkey parts instead mm-hmm. of a whole turkey. I've started doing that because you can make your own turkey. If more people like, turkey only comes with two drumsticks, which is a problem in my house. The turkey I designed by buying parts has four drumsticks, four thighs, and one whole breast. Because my family all loves it. It's Franken turkey. But it's great because they're in parts. You salt them. You slow roast them. And the fact that, as Julia was saying, the breast meat and the dark meat cook to different temperatures. We like the dark meat to cook to about 10 degrees higher than the breast meat. Well, that means you can take the breast meat out when it's done and keep the dark meat still in there. And to me, it's perfect if you have, a cantankerous uncle that is going to fight you for that drumstick. And again, there's only two of them. I've got two boys, and they both pretend like they're Henry VIII with the giant turkey leg. And then I don't get one. The other thing is wings. Julie and I love turkey wings. So you can
call them kitchen snacks.
A whole sheet pan of turkey wings,
yes,
and it
please.
Just tastes so good.
So build your own.
Build your own build turkey. Your own it's turkey. Like Lego turkey.
And with Black Friday, it heralds company Christmas party season potluck season where we've got this thing on Thursday or, you know, a couple of days down the road. Everybody's bringing a dish. What would be some good ideas as far as assembling? It's this kind of falls in the category of easy to make. And maybe these might be a recipe or two might be in in this book. What would be some suggestions if someone has to whip up a casserole or something like that that's easy but substantive?
Well, I was going to say one of the things if you're taking potluck, it can be problematic if you're bringing something that needs to be heated, because often there's a lack of oven space to reheat things or. I love to bring quick breads, like pumpkin breads and banana breads, Julia's favorite banana bread, cakes and things like that, because nobody hates dessert at a party. And that's the one time you can say, oh, I'll have a slice of that. I think for potlucks, you know, again, the slaws and the salads and the hearty, cold side dishes are going to stick out from everybody else's baked brown casserole. And they're going to offer a fresh counterpoint that people will remember.
Yeah, I think, you know, potlucks have changed nowadays. They're more modern. They're more current. It's not all about the cheesy old casserole. It's about a grain salad. So if you show up with a quinoa salad or a wheat berry salad with, you know, goat cheese and blueberries, that's going to be really well received because it is a counterpoint to what potlucks have been in the past and maybe some of the heavier dishes around. So bring something healthy. Bring something fresh, green, and healthy. You don't have to worry about heating it up. You can make it in advance. And it'll be, you know, it's a welcome change of pace.
Nice. So this is, as I said, this has been a career for both of you. And it's work. What do you like about cooking?
That is a question.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's deep, man.
I don't think I've ever been asked that. Well, I like eating.
Yeah, I was going to say, the reason I got into cooking is because I like to eat. And that's the first thing. You're hungry before you learn how to cook. One directly leads to the other. So, yeah, that's how I got into it.
Yeah, and it's cooking to me is a little bit, it's part chemistry, part magic. It's amazing. You take part A, part B, mix together, add heat, you get X. You know, I always tell my kids that the oven is actually a magic box. You put in raw, gross cookie dough, actually yummy cookie dough. I have no problem eating cookie dough. Put it in the oven. It comes out. It looks different. It smells different. It feels different. There's a magic that happens. And their baking especially is kind of a, you know, what's behind the curtain. And then it comes out and it's completely different. So I think there's just it's a science experiment that we deal with every day, cooking and baking.
For me, it's also working with my hands, which is, you know, a skill, a craft. It's not on the computer. It's not, you know, talking on the phone and in lots of meetings. It's just me and the food, and I'm chopping, and I love chopping. It's my zen time. I put the music on, and I could chop for hours and be very happy. And so it's the physical act of just working with ingredients, working with fire, having pans, being busy with my hands, and having the smells and the visual cues when things are done. That's what's really pleasurable to me.
And it's so satisfying.
Yeah.
After the work, you get to eat something that tastes great.
So and there's a reward.
Right.
Cookies. Holiday cookies. Mm-hmm. What is your first go-to if you're gonna make something to take to work or for the house? What's your go-to for a cookie recipe?
My go-to, yeah, I have two. One is called, and they're kind of unusual. I mean, I think everyone can bring a plain cutout cookie that you've decorated with your kids or yourself because it's fun to decorate cookies. But I think if you bring something a little unusual and something that speaks to your heritage, that's fun. And so one of my cookies is a Liebkuchen. It's a German spice cookie with a ton of nuts and some citrus, and it tastes like the holidays with the warm spices and the nuts and the citrus, and it's unusual, and sometimes you can coat it with a little bit of chocolate, and it feels special. The other one is a nut crescent, which sometimes people call a Mexican wedding cookie or an Italian wedding cookie.
Or pecan sandy.
Or a pecan, yeah, no. And so it's powdered sugar, so it looks kind of snowy, and it's, again, very nutty, and to me, sort of warm nuts, warm toasted nuts, and using lots of them is a very holiday thing.
I have a couple as well. We have a big cookie stand in our house, and we're constantly putting together cookies. I need to get back into it. For years, I would actually bake cookie boxes and give them away as gifts, 4 or 5 different ones. Now I just make beer, and I give it to everyone.
Love the beer gift.
They're not complaining at the moment.
She makes great beer.
But the my two favorite cookies is one is a triple coconut macaroon. I am a coconut freak. I will eat coconut on anything. And there's 3 different kinds of coconut going into them. And they're in little pyramids, and you dip the bottom in bittersweet chocolate.
They're pretty.
Chewy and toasty and just a tad of chocolate. And my other favorite is a pretty recent recipe. It's called Millionaire Shortbread.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
And my husband's from Scotland, and he introduced me to Millionaire Shortbread when we were over there visiting family years ago. And we finally got around to developing a version for the magazine. And it's a pressed shortbread bread crust right in the bottom of a pan. And then you make this treacly, toffee, gooey layer. So easy to make. And you pour that over and it sets up. And that toffee layer is so buttery, almost toasted butter flavor. Then right over it, you melt this bittersweet chocolate. And it's just a veneer, the thinnest veneer of chocolate on top. So it's not a chocolate dessert. Doesn't take away from the other 2 components. You let it set up. You cut it into these beautiful batons, and you see these 3 layers, and it's incredibly impressive. People think that you bought them at a bakery. They taste better than a bakery, I think.
And the recipe is really easy.
It's so
That's
easy.
The beauty of that one.
How Millionaire long shortbread.
If it's that, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of time that goes into something like this.
Sure.
But it's very easy.
Every single step is easy. There are 3 components. The shortbread crust comes together in seconds in the food processor, and you press it in. There's no rolling out or anything like that. The toffee is, it's not really making a real candy toffee. It's kind of a cheater toffee. It has a little bit of sweetened condensed milk in it. So it's already partially there. And that way, it's basically you bring it up to a boil to a certain temperature and pour it in.
And it's pretty foolproof.
Foolproof.
With that kind of evaporated milk.
Right.
Sweetened condensed milk.
Yeah. And I have to say, if you make a mistake on this recipe, it still tastes really good.
And that's in the book.
That's in the book, yeah.
Yeah.
What? Tell us a little more about the book. What else is in it?
So, you know, I think people ask us all the time, what do we cook at home? Because we're both working mothers. We know a lot about food, and we taste a lot of food. As we mentioned, we've tasted over 20,000 recipes in our tenure at America's Test Kitchen. And so these are the recipes from work that we bring home that resonated with us and with our families and fit into our schedules. So this is what we cook at home and how we sometimes even alter the recipe, which... You know, gasp, we alter the recipe
You're not
from
allowed
the test
to do
kitchen.
That.
Yes, but you know what? We all do it because if you work with enough, you can really figure out what ingredients you have on hand instead and what your family might like. So this is our answer to that. And you get to know a little bit more about us and about our families.
Yeah, there's a lot of tie-ins to memories that are connected to these recipes in here. So little stories about something we remember when it was being developed or the first time we tasted something. All these little stories. So these recipes, besides just being great food that we make again and again, really mean something to us.
And coming back around to the whole idea of a timeline and preparation. Oh, it's lunchtime. Oh, it's breakfast. And here I am worrying about making dinner in 5 hours. And I think the trap during the holidays is before you know it, you've inhaled a bag of crackers or something.
So true.
Because you're too busy preparing a meal down the road. What type of meals do you, how do you do that to handle sort of the appetite leading up to the big meal without diving into cookies or grazing and eating a bunch of things you really shouldn't be eating?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things is if your oven is on and you're making, I have what I call cook days. Because I try to avoid that last-minute grabbing of the crackers. So if, you know, leading up, say I'm making a stew, well, I'm already in the kitchen. I'm already prepping X for stew. So it's not going to take me very long to throw chicken, a whole chicken, on a roasting pan and also throw it in the oven. I'm going to have the chicken that night for dinner and leftovers, and then the stew is going to be for the next night. So I think that's really important. Your oven's already on. What can you do on the oven? You have 4 burners at a minimum, usually. You know, you're already there attending one burner. Is there something you can put right next to it so you can think about the next day? And things like stews, soups are great for make ahead. And also lean meats, because things like pork tenderloin, chicken, anything like that, well, you can serve it cold in a salad the next day. And you don't have to worry about the main course if you're feeding people that like to eat meat.
Yeah, for me, it's having, like you said, some lean meats, having chicken, grilled chicken, cold, even cold cuts mm-hmm. at the last minute if you don't want to cook, and crudité platter, just cut up the vegetables and have that and fruit within reach. Mm-hmm. Because, right, you're going to eat, people eat at 2, 3, 4, sometimes noon. It's an early meal, so you don't want to fill up at breakfast, but you need to eat something for breakfast. You need to have a little protein to, you know, sustain you. And of course, you're going to have a gobbler sandwich later at night. So it's really just to get you to Thanksgiving.
Excellent. And season 18 is definitely coming up. What has filming began? Tell me a little
bit
about
that. It's in the
can. It's in the can.
It's in the can.
Yeah. So we film a season for us is 26 episodes, and we film it all at one time. So it's about 3 weeks straight. We film all the recipe parts of this show all together, and we do about 5 to 6 recipes a day. Mm-hmm. And then all the tastings and testings happen in one day. So it's a very efficient schedule. The tapings in the can, it was a fun year.
It was a fun year. Mm-hmm. It's so amazing when we're, you know, there's so much planning going into the show, and then it happens so quickly. And then we're like, did that just happen? What happened? Where were we? It's a pretty amazing thing. Three weeks. To get all that done.
Yeah, it's a lot of food in 3 weeks. It is. Yeah, foodapalooza.
I mean, do you have meals during this time, or is it just filming sort of?
We have wine during this time. Wine and coffee. No, we're eating. We are eating all day. You're authentically eating the food. The one thing, we don't do a lot of salads on the show because they're just not that engaging. I mean, how many times can you watch someone cut some lettuce and toss it with dressing? So we don't really bring food to America's Test Kitchen. I mean, I say it's like bringing coals to Newcastle, but you do bring vegetables and salad in particular. So I think in the back in the green room, it's a lot of water and a lot of salad.
And when's the premiere this year?
New seasons will start appearing next January.
Next January.
Yeah, and here and it's at WETA Channel 26 here in Washington.
Excellent. Thank you. And Cook's Country, what's on tap for that this season?
We're going to start filming that in December. And it's an exciting show because we're really tapping into what the story of Cook's Country is, which is the story of America through food, how different regional places have their unique dishes and how they got there, who migrated to that part of the country, and this became the dish of the area. And what does that say about us as Americans? And I love that part of it, telling the story of America through food. And so there's a lot of travel pieces, and there's really putting the spotlight on different parts of the country. And best of all, it's in our new space. It's in our new huge kitchen, which is beautiful. So it'll be the first look at the new kitchen.
Yeah, we have a lot of great stories leading into the recipes, too. Mm-hmm. We have a cake called Wellesley Fudge Cake. that was made because back at the turn of the lot, not this century, but this century before that, fudge was contraband on Wellesley campus.
In Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yep.
It was contraband. And it was the founder, Henry Fowle Durant, who founded Wellesley College. He was really into health food, and he had strict beliefs that the students should not eat sugar and all sorts of things. And he had this saying.
Pies, lies, and donuts will never have a place at Wellesley College.
So students reacted as students do, and they rebelled by having secret fudge-making parties in their dorm rooms. I'm not kidding you. They had secret chocolate parties. And the town of Wellesley started making a cake with a fudge-based frosting, just as a little, you know, here you go, kids. Here's some more fudge-based frosting. It's called a Wellesley fudge cake. It's delicious. But even thinking, knowing that's the history of it, and the students rebelled for the sake of chocolate, I just love that story.
Well, it takes a chocolate cake that might just be a chocolate cake, and because there's something behind it, there's a story about it. It makes it a little bit more special.
Yeah, and there is another story of the gentleman who was responsible for all the concessions at the baseball parks. His name was
Stevens.
There you go.
Harry Stevens.
He started out just going to the baseball games, and I guess the baseball players, they didn't have names on their jerseys. So he couldn't tell the players who they were. So he made scorecards with the players' names, and he started selling those. And then he's like, oh, there's no snacks here. There's no drinks. So he started selling popcorn and pretzels. And before you know it, he was the major concessionaire all over the country, every major ballpark. And he sold his company in 1991 to Aramark. I mean, it was a big company he built. And he was a baseball fan through and through. And so it's just interesting to hear about the immigrants who come in and they see a need and they fill a gap and they fill it with their home food. And for and a lot of ballpark concessions, you realize they're German. It's pretzels. It's beer. And why is that? Why is it bratwurst and pretzels at ball games?
Right.
And so it's interesting to know what we think of as an American culture to learn where its roots are.